No, no, that's not theme music. That's a sting, and I shouldn't have said that because it'll only confuse the issue. Remember, this program is the only democracy on the ABC. You get to vote. So if you want to change the theme, don't forget to vote. If you want to, you know, if you want to keep the theme, don't forget to vote. And if you want to exhume the corpse of Johann Sebastian and go back into the past of the program, don't forget to vote. We learn from history that we never learn anything from history. Famous words of Hegel. Now, Gladys, if you look at the way Western leaders, and I'm talking about the US, Britain, and to some extent Australia, conduct and then end wars, those words seem very appropriate. And my next two guests have done extensive research about the final stages of a battle and what happens the day after the conflict is supposed to have closed. As I said, my personal ethicist, Dr. Simon Longstaff, is within. He was without before, but he's now within. Simon is Executive Director of the St. James Ethics Centre and looks after my moral torments on an hourly basis. We have a very distinguished guest from the US, Gideon Rose. He's editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, and that's an immensely powerful journal. He's on The Blower from New York to discuss his new book, How Wars End, Why We Always Fight the Last Battle. Now, I will point out to you, the listener, and to my guests that, yes, we will get on to Iraq and Afghanistan in due course, but I want to cover some broad areas before we do. Now, Gideon, as someone who's examined the closing stages of each modern war the US has been involved in, would you be kind enough to tell us what errors the governments in charge tend to make in their plans to end combat?
Well, basically, they tend to think about war as only half the way they should. War has two different aspects. There's a negative aspect, the beating up the enemy aspect, and there's the positive aspect, the constructing some sort of stable political settlement on the other side aspect. And what I find is that governments and peoples, too, tend to focus on the first, beating up the enemy, and not really think about the latter, the politics, until the end of the day. So you go to Baghdad and think that your job is toppling Saddam Hussein, and you get there and you wake up like Robert Redford at the end of The Candidate, the famous movie, and say, well, what do we do now? And the problem is that by focusing only on war as combat, war as fighting, which is an important, obviously crucial part of the operation, it's not enough by itself, and you need to think about how to create a political settlement on the other side, because that's the only way at the end of the day to make sure not just that the problem goes away, but that it doesn't come back afterwards.
You make the point that the war in Korea was extended for propaganda reasons, and many of us would take the view that Nixon did that with Vietnam. But what about Wilson's response to World War One?
Well, one of the things I find is that people tend, for some strange reason, not to think very sophisticatedly about what they're doing. So someone like Wilson, even a brilliant political scientist and very smart, serious, intellectual guy like Wilson, defines the goal in World War One, let's say, among other things, as making the world safe for democracy, pursuing what we would call now regime change in Germany. But he doesn't really operationalize that goal. He doesn't ask himself carefully beforehand just what that's going to look like. And so at the end of World War One, when you have some interesting negotiations in the fall, turns out that Wilson is confronted with the question of whether a constitutional monarchy in Germany would count as a democracy. And he's totally flummoxed because he's never asked himself, okay, just what does democracy actually mean?
Well, that's still a challenge, too.
I would give governments is,
sorry, that's that idea of defining
terms like.
Okay. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but I have to make this point, that the definition of democracy still bedevils contemporary precedents, doesn't it?
Exactly, and that's why thinking about things in big, broad, abstract terms like democracy or victory isn't really helpful, because what you really want is a specific, concrete, practical question about the political structure on the other side of the day. It doesn't matter whether Afghanistan is a democracy, or Iraq's a democracy. It matters who is going to be in charge politically and how are we going to create a stable political settlement.
Now, of course, you're right that Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, resolved not to repeat Wilson's mistakes dithering while Germany slipped into chaos, but never considered what would happen to his own elaborate post-war arrangements should America's wartime marriage of convenience with Stalin break up.
Well, that's a fascinating case, too, because basically people have enough problems dealing with the war at hand that they can really, they try to avoid thinking about future problems. And so we had to basically partner with the Soviet Union, with Stalin, to beat up Hitler in World War II. It was a logical thing to do, but it was going to create problems later on. But it's almost too difficult and disturbing to think about future conflicts. And so Roosevelt never bothers to say to himself, gee, what's going to happen after the war when we basically are at odds with the Soviet Union? And that, so he creates post-war plans based on everything being hunky-dory. And essentially something like the Cold War was probably always in the offing. But the hysteria and disappointment and surprise of it shouldn't have been, and that only came from denying to ourselves early on just what kind of Faustian bargain we were making.
Let's now bring my personal ethicist into the discussion. Good on you, Simon. How do you react to what Gideon's been saying? What takes place during the closing stages of a war?
Well, Gideon's precisely right. In fact, the whole justification for war depends on getting right what he's talking about. If you look at the notion of just war theory for centuries now, it's got a number of components. For example, ideally it should be in the defence of others. Tolerably it can be in your own self-defence. But a constant theme within the literature and thinking is that the purpose of the war must be to secure a peace, but not just any kind of peace. It must be a peace that is superior to that which would have prevailed if the war had not been fought. So you go back to Gideon's various examples and you ask yourself objectively, did those who prosecuted the war have that in mind? Did they ensure that they properly arranged their affairs so that they could secure that kind of peace? And if they didn't, then the whole justification for taking up arms in the first place is lost.
It's interesting. The last time I heard the term just war was when we took the program around from a few cities in the run-up to Iraq. And we had theologians and soldiers and historians arguing about whether that war could be just. But, of course, they were confused because they were justifying those who thought it could be just on false information.
They were, and I think that the principles are pretty clear as to what counts as a just war. In my own judgment, the first Iraq war to remove them out of Kuwait, the Iraqis, no problems at all. It's almost a textbook case. Second one, very profound difficulties in justifying that. But the more general case that Gideon's put in play here is to ask whether or not those who plan wars and then subsequently cause them to be executed have made adequate provision in their own thinking and their resourcing
peace. And they avoid rushing to the proud, vainglorious announcement of mission accomplished.
Well, that, but also, secondly, and you talked about the case of where war is extended for reasons which are purely self-serving by the country concerned, either to secure some kind of strategic advantage which is completely unrelated to the conflict in which you're engaged, or for some popular domestic purpose. If you extend war, which is a terrible disaster that befalls any human community, for those sorts of reasons, then there's no justification at all. I mean, some people might say it's just practically useful to do, but within the tradition of just war, it just fails.
Gideon, do you take the just war notion seriously?
I think it is a great tradition ethically, and I think it really is a wonderful way of thinking about war. But sometimes it's just another way of talking about very difficult questions without necessarily providing a perfect answer. So, for example, with regard to the first Gulf War in 1991, I think they did indeed handle it well, and it was just to go after Kuwait. But by only going after Kuwait, you leave the question of what happens to Iraq itself and Saddam Hussein up in the north still up in the air. And so something they should have thought about is not so much whether it made sense to topple Saddam in 1991, but rather if you're only going to do the Kuwait part of the job, then what do you do afterwards? How do you end up containing Saddam in a sustainable long-term way afterwards? So just war theory, I think, is very important for the ethical side of things, but there are still very difficult questions. There's no free lunch in international politics. And if you don't deal with problems, they don't get better. So you need to find a way of dealing even with the problems you don't choose to solve with the war itself. You need to find a way of dealing with them afterwards.
There are pragmatic things in this too, though, Gideon, which are, I mean, one of the lessons learned by the United States, and it's in their counterinsurgency manuals now, is that famous formulation that if you lose moral authority, you lose the war. And I think that the failure to have proper attention to the things that you've been raising, which includes concrete plans relevant to the countries where you are going to secure the peace, you ultimately lose moral authority, and I think you lose the battles at home as well. So even your own objectives are undermined by a failure to take these things into account.
I think that's absolutely true. My only point is that even the just wars by themselves, if they're properly limited, can still leave problems afterwards. When we pushed people out of South Korea in the Korean War, when we pushed Saddam out of Kuwait, we still left the people of North Korea and the people of Iraq in trouble afterwards. And so while our wars were there were just, and while it made sense to limit them, we shouldn't kid ourselves that problems we don't deal with go away. We still had to deal with North Korea and Iraq, and it wasn't very nice for either the North Koreans or the Iraqis when we stopped sort of halfway done.
I vividly remember, Simon, how popular the Shah of Iran was in the wide world for quite a long time. Mm. I remember when the Australian film industry overcame any of its ethical scruples and rushed off to film festivals under his auspices. Now, I raise the Shah because that's a very significant regime change. We saw the subsequent revolution led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, and everyone was pretty excited about that at the time. You know, there was a bit of a fan club in the West. But that turned out to be incredibly messy and still is.
Well, I think that part of the problem is that often people who are planning these things from a military point of view fail adequately to take into account the cultural setting in which these things are going to be worked through. And your conversation earlier on about, well, what is democracy? How do we tell what counts? Is a good example of that. There are lots of arrangements which you could have which would count as being democratic, but not necessarily reflecting the sorts of democracy we'd have in Australia or the United States. And I think in Iran and a number of other miscalculations that have been made, it's the failure to attend to those underlying cultural elements right across, you know, religion, language, a whole lot, that means that people, they muck it up, basically.
Gideon, wars, we talk about those that plan wars, but this is often fragmented and not monolithic in your own structure. You know, you can have the Pentagon making one set of plans, the White House is doing another, there's a division between state and, you know, and so on. And I remember when we were looking at the forthcoming war in Iraq, it was quite obvious that there were people in Washington who were thinking clearly about what a mess it could become, but they weren't being listened to by other branches of the administration. Isn't that one of the major problems?
Well, you know, there's always an old expression in America, a fish rots from the head. And I think the problem is that the president and the national security advisor, who really are the sort of key people involved in coordinating and responsible for coordinating national policy, have to be doing their job well. In Iraq, you're right, there were terrible bureaucratic divisions and a terrible lack of planning. It made no sense at all to entrust all post-war planning to the one department, the Department of Defense, that really didn't care about the post-war situation at all. But I think as bad as the Department of Defense's execution of the task was, the real burden of blame goes on the president, the national security advisor, on Bush and Condi Rice. Bush for making bad decisions and Rice for not staffing him appropriately and making sure that there were tough questions asked at every step along the way about how this was going to be done.
But of course, you're talking about a president who didn't like tough decisions and he had a very short attention span.
Yes, and this is part of the problem, which is, you know, Wilson famously said once in one of his Latin American forays that he was going to teach Latin Americans to elect good men. Part of the problem is you have to elect leaders who take war seriously, both in terms of its moral and its intellectual aspects, and essentially understand that this is a very, very complex, difficult political challenge, and how to try to marry force to politics is a really tough task that you have to confront squarely and rigorously from the beginning and all the way through.
If we look at our local dilemmas, Simon, we're not confronting exit strategies from Afghanistan too well at the moment, are we?
Well, I think we've just had an interesting debate in the Parliament about what we're doing there. I mean, the trouble, I think, now for the the political debate in Australia is that we can't undo the fact that there was an earlier commitment made and we've got people there. And if, and I think, I mean, there are arguments on both sides of this clearly, but I think that once you've committed your troops to this situation, once you've made the commitment to this kind of activity, yes, you should have an exit plan, but it's got to be one which actually secures some kind of benefit in terms of the quality of the peace that's left behind. And we have this terrible situation in Afghanistan now with a government which wouldn't meet many of the standards that any of us would want to uphold in our own country, in which there's divisions in the allies as to who's doing what there, question about whether there's a sufficient scope in terms of the military planning to achieve the objectives. All of this makes for a very muddled situation, and I'm not sure that at the moment Australia has a sufficient voice amongst the leadership of that whole campaign to really be making strategic input in the way that we probably ought to be able to.
Well, you and I live in a country where very often these decisions are made for us in Washington.
Indeed.
Just as they were once made for us in London. This is LNL on Radio National, and my guests are the editor of Foreign Affairs, that vastly influential journal, Gideon Rose, and Simon Longstaff, who's the exec director of the St. James Ethics Centre. Gideon, one of the really fascinating things you do is you put readers in the room with US officials as they make decisions that will affect millions of lives and shape the modern world, seeing what they saw, hearing what they heard, feeling what they felt. Can you just give us a Reader's Digest condensed version of that?
Well, basically, one of the things that you're saying, that decisions are often made for you guys in Washington, and that's true, and it's also true for Americans, because even though it's made in America, it doesn't mean that all the ordinary public necessarily has a huge amount to say, and we often don't know what exactly is driving decisions. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is make the very specific policy choices that presidents and their top advisors have confronted to reveal the specific details of that. So when you were talking about Afghanistan, what Obama is really faced with is a very tough, simple, straightforward decision, which is are the costs of staying in Afghanistan, do they outweigh the risks of leaving? And the kinds of questions that the Obama administration is asking themselves, very similar to those that, let's say, the Nixon administration asked itself in Vietnam, because in Vietnam, you were also in a sort of thankless counterinsurgency in a strategically marginal country, and they had to weigh questions not just of should I stay or should I go, but what are the consequences of our leaving? Can we extricate ourselves from the war without everything falling apart after we leave? And that's the same kind of question the Obama people are asking themselves today.
Have you noticed Obama getting up to speed, Gideon? Please tell me
he has. He's been something of a disappointment even for his many supporters, because in Afghanistan, at least, he seems to be feeling like the problem is his nasty, thuggish military advisors who are trying to trap him into a decision to stay. I think the military advisors are basically just trying to answer the question, look, you've told us this is important, here's what we think is necessary. And the real question is not so much one of the specifics of counterterrorism or counterinsurgency strategy. The real question is the political choice of, is it necessary for the United States and its allies to be responsible for security in Afghanistan? If so, that's a very difficult and thankless task, and we're going to be there for a while. But if you can feel like you're comfortable walking away and essentially letting the situation go back into some kind of chaos, then you can extricate yourself. But those are the tough choices. There's no free lunch out there, and I think that he needs to recognize that. And essentially his goal has been like St. Augustine's famous prayer, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. He wants to leave, but he doesn't want to do it right now. At some point, he's going to basically have to choose.
Simon, a final comment from you.
Well, it's really it's a question and a comment, and that is, when Obama's making these decisions, in whose interest does he ultimately act? Is he going to do so simply what is good for the United States in this case, with some view about its larger role in the world? Or does he give equal weight, or perhaps even more weight, to what's going to be the consequence of his departure or is his staying for the people of Afghanistan? And I think that question often gets overlooked, which raises many of the problems that Gideon's been pointing to.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, Dr. Simon Longstaff, exec director at the St. James Ethics Centre. And we're going to play a little bit of music, and we get stuck into Cecil B. DeMille.